And the Jays have won two straight. Barrios pitching very well last night. Kikuchi pitched really well the night before. Now you got Gausman going tonight, looking for the sweep. And to chat about that, amongst many other things, we're joined now by our TSN MLB and Blue Jay analyst here, Steve Phillips. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great. Good to be with you guys.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. We were just having a conversation about the anniversary of David Wells and his perfect game and how he admitted that he was out the night before and was so hungover. And it got us talking about all these different stories in sports history of players that would be out the night before a big game. How often during your days of being a GM were you aware of your players possibly doing that, whether it was for a home game, a road game? And if you came across that information, how would you handle that?
So, you know, I will tell you that more often than not, players are pretty close-mouthed about that stuff. Now, I, you know, every once in a while when we would travel to Montreal, I would hear them say team meeting at a certain location there.
And I
guess I figured they weren't talking baseball. But I got to tell you that I didn't get the sense of it very much. And we had a lot of veteran players that were, you know, I mean, David Wells was a unique cat. I mean, he was a little different guy. But it got to the point that most players had a level of respect for their teammates, the game. And when your star players are guys who toe the line, then, you know, you don't worry too much. Like, so I had Mike Piazza, and I never had to worry about Mike Piazza. I mean, after the game, he would drink Gatorade and eat power bars and protein bars. And everything was in moderation, was sort of the way he looked at it. Now Leiter was a leader on the team, and John Franco. And so, you know, they all had fun, but they all understood, you know, the nature of the game and what they needed to do. So I didn't really have to deal with that too much. I guess the one time we flew over and started the season in Japan, I was a little worried about that just because of the jet lag factor and everything else with guys going out, how it would impact them. But, you know, we split the two game series and we came back and went on to the World Series that year. So I would say that generally speaking, unless I thought there was a problem with somebody where they had some issue off the field, I tended to keep my head down and not mess with the guys because I respected that they cared about the team and the game. More often than not, I think they showed up in a pretty good state to be able to perform.
Steve, in the NHL, there's like a mandatory, I think teams set a curfew to cover their own asses, and they said you should have been in your hotel room at 11. Was there anything like that, or was it just honor system in baseball?
Yeah, I think that it depended, you know, but I think most managers, it was, you know, like Davey Johnson with the Mets forever said, I only have two rules. Don't be late and be ready to play. And if you can do that, then I don't care what else you do. I think some teams put curfews in place. Now, one of the things I did do was I banned alcohol, and this did not go over well, but I took alcohol out of the clubhouse after games. Because I didn't want to provide alcohol, then have somebody drive home, and have an accident, and be like, well, we're the ones who gave him alcohol, so why would we do that? And then even on return flight, because I didn't want to have guys fly across the country, drink all the way, and then get in their car and drive home. That didn't seem right. So it was met initially with like, you know, why are we doing it? I just said, listen, liability, man, insurance. I mean, the way the world is today, I can't do that to the organization, and it's not the right thing for me to do. Now, it doesn't mean that they didn't have somebody, you know, grab some beers and put them in a brown paper bag and bring them on the airplane. And I knew there was some of that, but it did set the tone for understanding that there's got to be some moderation in everything that takes place.
Do you think Wade Boggs would have demanded a trade immediately if he was on your team?
Yeah. As long as we had chicken for him, I think he was okay because he's okay. One of those guys that was superstitious. He had chicken before every game. Because, you know, look, it worked for him. He got 3,000 hits. But there were guys. You know what it was is, you know, the old times, players would sit around the clubhouse and drink beer all night. And that was kind of the way it was. And here's the reality of it, that they drank beer because they needed to come down from the amphetamines that they had taken. And that's why so many baseball players, alcoholism was somewhat rampant in baseball was guys would take amphetamines, and then after the game they would drink in order to come down from the amphetamines. And then what would happen is the next day, because they drank so much, they'd have to take more amphetamines, and then they'd have to drink more to come down. And it became this vicious cycle. And so, you know, and I just was not going to play into that. And, you know, now we know that amphetamines are banned in baseball, and they test for it, although they didn't for the longest time. And when I was general manager, they didn't. And, you know, and I will say that when I was general manager, I heard players say in the clubhouse, if you need them, get them. If you have them, share them. And I, first I was like, oh, I wonder what that means. And I'm like, oh, okay, I think I know what it means. Is that,
yeah.
And then, you know, you see guys taking cups of coffee and swish them back and forth between two cups, trying to dissolve, you know, something within their coffee. So, you know, and here's the thing. It, back then, there was no testing for it. And, you know, it's funny, when they banned amphetamines in baseball, there were former players who said they're going to have to shorten the season to 120 games because it's not humanly, physically possible to play the game without that. Now, obviously, that's not true, and players are doing it. But, you know, when they banned amphetamines in baseball, the prescriptions from doctors for Ritalin went up 250%. That because players wanted something to get their focus, and so they then went to doctors to get prescriptions written, which was then legal as long as you had a written prescription from doctors. So, you know, guys would do things to get an edge. Guys would do things, you know, some because they needed it, but... but it was, you know, it was a pretty big issue. I mean, back in the 70s, that stuff was in the clubhouse. I mean, doctors would bring in jugs of amphetamines in clubhouses. Now, it got dramatically cleaned up, and it was hidden more than that. And but I, you know, I mean, I remember acquiring a player who had had some suspension for drug use before, and he was getting tested. And he said to me, he said he was an older player. He said, hey, kid, I can't play without my beans. I need my beans. Can you call somebody? And then he'd come into the training room with a pill and say to the doctor, hey, doc, what is this? And the doctor would say, well, where'd you get it? He said, well, don't worry about where I got it. What is it? Can I take it? And the doctor's like, I don't even know what it is. Like, it's a pill. Like, I have no idea what it
right.
is. And so there was, you know, it was guys trying to gain advantages. And, you know, they've done a lot to clean the game up that way.
Oh, for sure. With Steve Phillips. So we were talking about the Springer triple last night, and a lot of that had to do with mistakes in the outfield. You know, it was a bloop single. It probably should have scored a run, maybe two. It turns into a triple, and I credit Springer for getting out of the box quick, and then by the time he was rounded first, he had triple in his eyes, and he went for it, and it was a play at third. And to me, those are the most exciting plays in baseball. You know, a play in the second, third, a play at home is, in my opinion, the most exciting play in baseball. And you just don't see it that often. How much of it is based on you just don't see mistakes enough at the major league level to allow for that kind of activity on the base paths? Because I think that's what's needed when we talk about where the game is going and the effect of the shift, et cetera. We need more life on the bases, and we saw it last night.
Yeah, you know, what happens is because it's such a home run based game, you know, the running of the bases has become less of an issue because guys trot around the bases now,
right.
You know, and you don't see the single to left field or the double in the gap of the guy trying to score from first base because everybody's trying to hit the ball over the wall. Now, you know, the ball's not traveling quite as far, and so maybe we're going to start to see that more. I also think the other thing next year, when they make the bases bigger, you know, they're talking about making them instead of 15 inches, making them 18 inches. And when you think about that, the stolen base is going to become much more of a factor. Speed, because, you know, when you're on first base, you're going to be 4.5 inches closer to second base. The 3 inches off first and an inch and a half off second. 4.5 inches, you know what that's like? Think about all the bang-bang plays on stolen bases that we see today. It's going to dramatically change the way bases get run. And so I do think that we're, you know, next year going to see a lot more action on bases with base stealing, which is going to have all elements of the game, and it brings the speed player back into the mix instead of the home run hitter, which I think will give us more of that base running excitement that we really all really missed from the past.
With Steve Phillips, our TSN MLB and Blue Jay analyst. So Buster Olney was on with First Up this morning, and Buster had been writing about Juan Soto, the new ownership down in Washington that could be on the horizon, and what it means for Soto and his future. And here's what he had to say about what a rival GM had told him in terms of Soto and where he could end up if a trade were to ever happen.
But the other day I had an interesting conversation with a rival executive who's all over the trade market, and he mentioned the name of Juan Soto, who is, you know, he is this generation's version of Ted Williams in terms of how great he is. And he goes, you know, the Nationals are going to have to deal with the situation sooner rather than later.
So he went on to mention that the Padres and the Blue Jays were the two teams he was hearing. You didn't hear it in that clip. But does that make sense to you? If Soto became available, how do the Blue Jays make that work?
Well, I mean, they'd have to put Gabby Moreno and, you know, or Elvis Martinez and, you know, arms back in the deal. And, I mean, it would take a mega deal. So now here's the thing. Soto is not going to sign before becoming a free agent. You know, Scott Boras is his guy. You know, they got offered $350 million and didn't even counter it with a proposal. They just want to wait and play it out. And so, you know, whomever gets him will, you know, may have a chance to sign him. And yet, you know, unless you have the biggest offer on the table when it all comes down to it for Juan Soto, you're not going to get him. So I'm not sure trading for him is necessarily the right thing, because, you know, you're going to give up all the prospects and then you're going to have to give him the money too. I might as well just wait and give them the money and keep the prospects, because I'm going to need them to play with Juan Soto and pay him if I'm going to sign him as a free agent. So it's going to be an interesting one. You know, it's going to be Scott Boras, you know, doing his thing and trying to maximize the market. And, you know, it will be all free agency, and there will be opt-outs all over the contract and you know, escalators in the deal. And so, you know, I just look at it and think, I don't need to have the highest paid player to win, you know, and how often does the team with the highest paid player actually win? We saw the Texas Rangers do it with A-Rod back in the day, and it didn't prove, you know, I mean, they ended up getting rid of him because they couldn't win that way. And so, I don't know. I love Juan Soto, but, you know, look, he's on the Nationals right now. They're not winning anything because one guy can't do it. I'd rather have two $25 million players instead of one $50 million player. Yeah. Just because, you know, I just don't see paying somebody $50 million and that the production, he's going to be better than everybody else, but not worth the extra $30 million over a $20, $25 million player.
Two quick things. Happy birthday. Heard a vicious rumor about that.
Yes, yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, but I tell you, feeling old, man. Feeling old today.
We're all getting there, but I know we don't have much time, but you just mentioned Scott Boras. Is he, when you're a GM, is he an intimidating guy? Is he somebody that, you know, GMs are afraid of, or do they welcome the battle to, you know, kind of get a deal with his clients?
I think he's one of the easier guys to negotiate with, at least for me, because I don't play the game of chase. I just go to where I think the value is, and then I stop. And so, because, you know, there's always the secret team, the mystery team that's in. There's always the, you know, these teams are in, and they might be willing to go to this level. And I'm like, well, then I'm not going to pretend to chase it. Because every time I've heard A-Rod, back in the day, Kevin Brown, teams weren't within $20 million, $40 million of the final offer. And those teams chased a ghost. And so I was never going to be in a position to do that. I would say, this is the value I have for your player. This is what I'm willing to do. If it doesn't work, great, then let him go somewhere else. But I think you have to be really rigid with your boundaries with Scott.
Happy birthday, Steve. Thank you for doing this, buddy.
No, my pleasure, guys. Thanks so much. Have a good night.
There's Steve Phillips, our TSN MLB and Blue Jay analyst.
And
Birthday boy. Yep.
You're loving that clip.
That's the first time we've been back here where I...
You threw a dagger.
Nasty head shake. That was a death stare, a head shake, a hand.
We talked about the clip 15 times today.
No, you played the clip. Unfortunately, the most important part of the clip.
I know. It lacked the mention of the jig.
Yeah, can we just hear the clip, the normal clip, so we can hear it just for peace of mind?
Part. Well, let's keep in mind how I set it up. I'm like, he was talking to a rival exec, and all of it's, everything I said is in the clip, and then what we're looking for wasn't even in the clip.
We talked to a rival exec, and he mentioned Soto and possible other teams. Let's hear.
But the other day I had an interesting conversation with a rival executive who's all over the trade market, and he mentioned the name of Juan Soto.
Oh, great. So it's the same clip, yeah.
We didn't have the clip.
Well,
if the clip had continued, there was the mention of the Jays and the Padres, but you know what we had also talked about when talking about the clip.
But why did is the point.
Because we didn't want to have the clip too long. That's what I was thinking. Shorter the better. But
yeah, no, I agree with that, Crapler, but
don't let the facts get in the way of a good story.
I thought you said, remember Spider? What movie is that?
Oh, yeah, you're talking Goodfellas, yeah.
I thought you said you're Spider right now.
Yeah. That's Christopher Moltisanti, too, The Sopranos.
Yeah.
It's all good, Grappler.
It's all good.
It's all good. All right.
It's all good.
Got the point across.
That's silliness.
Yeah.
It's not.
Nothing you can do. It happens to the best of us, and we move on.
People have been asking about the lasagna.